From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about Act 31, the legislation that requires Wisconsin schools to teach about Native American history, culture, and tribal sovereignty. Then we'll speak with a local voice actor featured in an Ojibwe dubbing of Star Wars: A New Hope.
I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
Plus, we'll look at a book that explores the significance of corn to the Oneida Nation people.
It's brought us back to our language, to our culture, to our history. Corn has just really led the way for a different lifestyle, and we are so much happier because of it.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we're recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day by bringing you stories centered around Indigenous experiences and history. We'll start by learning about Act 31. More than 30 years ago, Wisconsin signed the law that requires schools to teach about Native American history, culture, and tribal sovereignty. The law was created in part because of a violent controversy over Ojibwe spearfishing rights, fueled by ignorance over those rights. State leaders realized that education about Native American tribes was needed in Wisconsin schools, and Act 31 was signed into law in 1989. To learn more about the history of Act 31 and where it stands today, WUWM education reporter Emily Files is joined by J.P. Leary, a UW Green Bay associate professor and author of the book, The Story of Act 31.
In this book, you say that to understand how Act 31 became law, you have to go back to the controversy around Ojibwe people's rights to spearfish in Wisconsin, what's also known as the Walleye War. So what was that controversy?
It all stems from really a lack of opportunity to learn about the history, culture, and tribal sovereignty of the federally recognized peoples in Wisconsin. If you were someone who the only thing you learned about Native people was from school, you didn't learn much. Your opportunities to learn were very, very limited. What happened is when the Ojibwe peoples sued to assert their rights because the state government had been interfering with their exercise for over a century, they finally won in 1983 in a case known as either as the Voight decision or as Le Couturier 1. So this controversy, this thing that many people had not known much of anything about, became something that was the cause of public controversy, public violence, and which I argue in the book is itself an educational outcome from lack of opportunities to learn.
So you mentioned that this goes back to the treaty rights of the Ojibwe people in Wisconsin. So let's talk about the treaty rights and the treaties themselves. Why were the treaties put in place and what did they say?
The primary treaties that were land cession treaties in Wisconsin among the Ojibwe people were 1837 and 1842. So what they did in those treaties, in 1837, it's also known as the Pine Tree Treaty because the United States was very interested in the timber resource. And so they negotiated with the Ojibwe people. And there are different understandings of that treaty. But what's very clear is the Ojibwe people reserved the right to hunt, fish, and gather within that territory ceded. They retained the right to make their way of life as they had done. And in 1842, what the federal government was very interested in was copper. And again, really thinking about economic development of that new Wisconsin territory. And once again, those Ojibwe tribal leaders retained the right to hunt, fish, and gather within that territory. They reserved the right explicitly to maintain their way of life. Once those treaties were ratified, once the reservations were created, there were a number of things the state government did to interfere with the exercise of those rights. There were people who were hunting or fishing off the reservation within the ceded territory that were cited for poaching. They might be cited. They might have their equipment confiscated. They might have their catch confiscated. They might be jailed. They might be fined. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in 1983 affirmed the continued existence of and validity of those reserved rights from treaties in 1837 and 1842. That treaty rights controversy became open and ugly and often violent. And it was termed in the news media and in some of the later scholarship as the Walleye War. And so one of the things that I'm arguing in the book is, yes, that was part of the immediate impetus for creating the instructional requirements in Wisconsin for teaching about Native people, but that it's part of a broader history, and that it was one just maybe the most immediate and most sort of spectacular in terms of scale, spectacular in a bad way. And there was a real fear that someone was going to get killed at a Wisconsin boat landing. There were examples of pipe bombs and people being shot at with firearms, people being shot at with wrist rockets, people being harassed, having their tires slashed, having their vehicles vandalized, and just a lot of things that were harassment of people legally exercising their court-affirmed reserved rights.
This kind of realization about Wisconsinites' lack of knowledge about Native American tribes and treaty rights came to a head with the spearfishing controversy and the embarrassment that it caused to state leaders. So
and harm. I think it's sure. You know, actual physical harm, economic harm, harm to the social fabric of communities, harm to families.
So what was the intent of Act 31? What did Act 31 set out to change?
The piece that's often thought of as the heart and soul of Act 31 speaks to K-12 social studies curriculum. And it requires school districts to provide instruction in history, culture, and tribal sovereignty at least twice in the elementary grades and at least once in high school. And, you know, in 2023, we look back at that and we say, well, what does provide instruction mean? But in 1989, with Wisconsin's long tradition of local control of education, provide instruction about the history, culture, and tribal sovereignty of the federally recognized tribes and bands in the state was the most specific curriculum content directive issued to Wisconsin schools until that time. Because of that tradition of local control, districts can provide that instruction wherever they'd like. Most commonly, it's in the context of Wisconsin history in fourth or fifth grade. Most commonly in the context of maybe U.S. history or world history in middle school. And coming up in high school, it might be in U.S. history. It might be in a civics and government class. There are at least one school, Black River Falls, that includes this content in all of their social studies offerings within the school district.
So Act 31 was intended to provide all public school students with knowledge about Native American history and culture and present day issues. And so how do you think Wisconsin has lived up to that goal?
Implementation has been uneven, right? And maybe that's being a bit charitable. One of the things that we see is difference in the view of what this was supposed to actually do. I think there were some among the coalition that created it that saw it as it was okay as being largely symbolic. And even the state superintendent at the time was saying, I wouldn't expect a whole week on this.
A whole week of instruction on it.
Right. Yeah. And so that's where I think about, like, if you want to do something meaningful as opposed to just do something, right? Provide instruction can mean a whole range of things. Provide instruction can be very, very minimal. right? And that minimum has never fully been defined. And so one of the things that we see come about is uneven implementation, right? In Black River Falls, Wisconsin, a since retired social studies teacher who now teaches for us at UW Green Bay, Paul Ricken worked with Charity Thunder and others in the Ho-Chunk community to begin to transform what had been their initial response to Act 31. So they found a way to infuse this content into everything they were doing in the social studies curriculum. And so in the context of civics, because they are located at the administrative headquarters of the Ho-Chunk Nation, they were able to go out to the tribal office building. They were able to go out and visit the tribal courts, and they were able to have that firsthand interaction with families, communities, and nation that was their neighbors. And so I think that's still one of the best approaches that we see. While we have those places that are like Black River Falls, really modeling great approaches, what I see in my classroom now is I do an activity on the second day of class. What's your prior knowledge? What have you learned? What have you been taught? And we got to be a little bit humble about it, because in some cases I'm asking them to think back to when they were in fourth grade, when perhaps earlier. And most of my students report very minimal opportunity to learn. They tend to report that way more often than not, what they learned was from mass media, not from in school. They cite Brother Bear, Pocahontas, Twilight, these sorts of things as their sources of information, rather than what they learned from their teachers, right? And so it may be that it wasn't offered to them. They didn't have that opportunity to learn. Or it could be that it was taught in a way that was perhaps superficial and not engaging.
So does it seem like Act 31 was more of a symbolic victory than a practical, like, change in Wisconsin?
I think, practically speaking, what Act 31 did is it provided some political cover to teachers, administrators, and school districts that wanted to do something meaningful, and that helped insulate them from the backlash, because they could point to that law and say, we are required to do this. I think it did that. I think it created some opportunity for innovation. It created some opportunity for partnerships and conversations. I think it's been consistently under-resourced, right? That there's been this specific requirement, but there's not been similar specific resources to support it.
J.P. Leary is a First Nations Studies professor at UW Green Bay and author of The Story of Act 31. He spoke with WUWM's Emily Files last year. The Star Wars universe was first introduced in 1977 with the film A New Hope. Since then, there have been many more films, series, and books that have kept us in a galaxy far, far away. Recently, Star Wars A New Hope has been dubbed in Ojibwe. The project is part of wider efforts to revitalize the language, which is used for one of the largest Native American tribes in the U.S. Nigani Anamaki Anini is the language culture coordinator of the Red Cliff Nation in northern Wisconsin and is also the voice actor for the character Red Leader in Star Wars. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share his experience bringing this version of the film to life.
Nigani, welcome to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Audrey.
So first off, are you a Star Wars fan?
Absolutely, since I was a child. How about you?
Absolutely. As I will show you over Zoom, the listeners can't see, but I have a Millennium Falcon tattoo. So, yes, Star Wars fan ever since I was little. My uncles first introduced me to the series, and they, of course, grew up with the original trilogy. So what was your first Star Wars exposure that got you hooked?
Well, if you remember in the 90s, they re-edited the original Star Wars. And so I watched those in theaters when I was a kid. And yeah, I've been a huge fan ever since.
Excellent. So you are a voice actor in the new release of Star Wars A New Hope in Ojibwe. So can you share how you heard of this opportunity and what the audition process was like? Because auditions were held in Manitoba, right?
Yeah. So I was perusing Facebook after work, like so many of us do. And I saw on one of my friends' pages an ad to apply to audition. And so that's where I learned about it first. And yes, the actual recording was in Winnipeg.
Okay. And did you know you were auditioning for the character of Red Leader, or was this just an open call, be a part of Star Wars?
Great question. So after I applied, I was invited to audition and to choose from several main characters to audition for. So I chose a handful, and the process was I had to record on my own computer reading lines in Ojibwe per character. And I was using my best intonations akin to what I was seeing in the original Star Wars, and then listening to the elders in my head to try and pronounce the Ojibwe the best I could. And I sent those in. And not long after, maybe a week or so, I heard back from the Disney crew asking for me to audition for one of those particular characters. We did the audition over Zoom with a director and one of her assistants. And, you know, I said the first two lines for this particular character. And she said, hold on. She offered me some suggestions. I took her suggestions to heart. I read the lines again, just one or two sentences. And then she said, you know what? I've heard enough. I've seen enough. I really like what you're doing here. I'm going to give you a role in Star Wars.
But you weren't sure which. It was just like, we're going to include you. Just wait and see.
Yes, yes. Didn't know yet which character. And I'm so proud to be giving voice to Red Leader, acted on screen by the late Drew Henley.
Of course. I mean, it's a big part, especially in the pivotal Death Star battle at the end of the film. And I can't imagine how anxious you were just, okay, knowing I'm going to be involved, don't know who or what so far. With Disney, and you think of Marvel movies, you know, were there NDAs, you know, where you kept under secret oath until, you know, the official word was out?
Yes, absolutely. We had to sign an NDA. I didn't, in fact, know who many of the actors were going to be until the release, the official news release.
Okay. So yeah, let's go into a bit more about the actual process of being a voice actor for A New Hope in Ojibwe. You're tasked with Red Leader. So did you also have to translate your part only, or was it a wider effort to help translate the whole Star Wars film? Can you just share how this process kind of unfolded for you?
Absolutely. So thankfully, Pat Nangawants, a first language speaker up north and a gifted teacher, she led a team of translators before these auditions. So the film was all of the script was translated ahead of time. And so when I was auditioning, I was given lines, and not just given lines on paper, but also a recording of an elder pronouncing the lines to give some enunciation guidelines there as well. And so I didn't have to do any of the translating. I'm so grateful for Pat Nangawants and her team.
Well, and I like that detail of having a recording of an elder as well, because, you know, you can share better insight than I in this, but how important is having that elder's voice and pronunciation and style? Because with keeping a language alive, I imagine that's crucial to keep the language as accurate as you can.
100%, Audrey. If one pronounces a word just slightly differently, it can offer a huge, entirely different meaning to a word.
So with your work in voicing Red Leader, can you share a bit of your methodology or technique? Was it either to mirror the original actor's cadence of the lines, or were you able to enjoy some freedom in interpreting it in your own way to best serve the Ojibwe language?
Great question. So how I've been taught, Ojibwe tends to have a flatness to it. There aren't as many accenting, if you will. And in English, of course, there is an accent and stresses in the words. And so I asked the production team, do you want me to offer a flat traditional Ojibwe pronunciation, or do you want me to emanate the English actors? And they invited me to shoot towards the English actors. And so what I did was I watched the original scene over and over and over and over again. I did some background research. I found that Mr. Henley had negotiated it with George Lucas. And at first, Mr. Lucas wanted Red Leader to be anxious from the beginning on out. And Mr. Henley thought that this character is a professional. He has years of experience. He's going to be calm throughout. And so what they negotiated, what they agreed upon was at first, Red Leader would be very calm and collected. And towards the end of that scene, when things are getting quite heated, he's going to grow a little more anxious. And so I brought that information with me into the sound studio. And the director also invited certain emotions, certain loudness, guiding me in the studio as well.
I love that. I also love that I learned a new Star Wars fact today with that background of the actor. Did you go into like Lucasfilm archives? Where did you find some of this research? Or did the director have some additional information for you all to really connect with this film on a deeper level like that?
I just dug in online.
That's a great resource.
Usually.
Yeah. Turn to all the Star Wars nerds online. They'll have an answer.
Wait, there's a lot out there.
Yeah. And with the Ojibwe language, as you mentioned, being a little more flat, the scene you're in is a battle scene. And I love this insight that you start calm, but obviously things heat up. Spoiler alert, Darth Vader eventually shoots you down. You crash into the Death Star. But what were some of the best challenges or learning experiences about being involved in this film?
Oh, it was a great experience working in the studio. It was my first Hollywood film studio setup. And so it was me in the sound booth, and then the booth next to me was the director, her production team, and an elder. And this elder was able to offer any pronunciation guidance on the fly in the studio, which is great. He was able to correct a couple of my words. And that was a really fun experience. And you know, joking with him back and forth in Ojibwe, that felt really good.
Having the experience of recording, voicing Red Leader, having the director, an elder there with you, it seems like such a great interactive experience. And this is obviously part of a much wider effort for all the voice actors involved in A New Hope. What significance do you place on the role of Ojibwe language in popular films like Star Wars?
You know, Pat Ngawang said it really well. She, earlier this year, was the keynote speaker at Anishinaabe Mwenteg, the world's largest conference on the revitalization of Anishinaabe language. And in her speech, she offered a vision of within 100 years, all of our communities are doing everyday things in our language. So that's an Ojibwe person being able to go to the store, go to the school, watch films. Anything that you can do in English, you can also do in Ojibwe. So a part of this vision is making sure that films are either dubbed or produced in the Ojibwe language. And so this is just one small tool to help in this larger revitalization effort.
And how does it feel for you personally to be a part of the Star Wars universe in your language?
It's an incredible honor. It's an incredible honor.
So if you're willing, I'd love to give listeners a little taste of your work in the film. Would you like to toss lines back and forth? I'll say the English and you can share the Ojibwe translation that you worked on.
Sure, let's do a few.
All right, so we are acting as Red Leader here. I'll start with the first line. Cut the chatter, Red 2.
Bunkatoon, Red 2.
Red boys, this is Red Leader.
Red me gazoo, mean Red Leader.
And the classic, pivotal line of Red Leader, almost there.
Ajagiga. Ajagiga.
And unfortunately, your first target miss just impacted the surface. Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you. So this is your first taste of acting, right? Of voice acting?
This is my first taste of voice acting. I've done a few small things in terms of acting. I'm also a film producer and director, but I want to expand more into voice acting and acting.
How did this experience of voice acting outside of the other projects you've worked on give you more insight into room to grow, not just for yourself, but for more production and projects for Ojibwe language-led films or translated films?
So many of my lines are actually yelled into the microphone, and I'm not much of a yeller. I'm not a very loud person. And so that took a lot of effort for me. And the director, she said, many of the indigenous actors she's worked with struggle with being extra loud. And so that's one area I want to work on.
Well, what a project to get you started on voice acting. Congratulations to you and the whole effort of this film. Nagani, thank you for joining me on Like Effect to share more about it.
Thank you so much. And I want to ask the audience, if you haven't seen this film yet, if you're a fan of Star Wars, if you're a fan of a good story, if you're interested in learning more Ojibwe, I strongly encourage you to go watch this film. It may still be in theaters in the Milwaukee area, I'm not sure. But if not, come October, the film will be on APTN and then on Disney Plus. I hope this film inspires many people to either begin or continue studying the Ojibwe language.
May the Force be with you.
And may the Force be with you.
Nigani Anamaki Anini is a voice actor for Star Wars Ojibwe, who gives voice to the character Red Leader. He is also the language culture coordinator for the Red Cliff Ojibwe Nation in northern Wisconsin. Anini spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last month. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a rare portrait at the Milwaukee Public Museum. But first, we'll learn how an author's experience growing corn created a community and a connection to her ancestors. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In the Oneida language, the word for corn has two meanings. It's our corn, but also our precious. Throughout time, corn has been a staple in the Oneida diet and an important part of daily and ceremonial life. When the Oneida people were forcibly removed from present-day New York State to the reservation in northeastern Wisconsin, they brought corn seeds with them. Saving those seeds and the knowledge to cultivate them is a tradition that's been passed down for generations. In her book, Rebecca Webster explores the relationship between Oneida people and corn. Webster is a citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. She and her husband own a farmstead on the reservation, where they grow corn and other Haudenosaunee varieties of beans and squash. They use their farm as a place to share their knowledge and teach community members how to reconnect with Oneida foodways. WUWM's Lena Tran spoke with Webster about the book.
I guess just to start, you know, where did this book begin for you and why corn?
Corn is the eldest of the three sisters, and she's the leader of those garden plants. And in so many ways, she has led us throughout all of our history. I really got swept away with the corn relatively recently. We didn't start growing our indigenous foods until 2015. We talked about growing our foods for a long time. It just wasn't feasible while I was in college, came back, had children right away. And finally, we just said, we need to do this. And we were really swept away by how much this food has connected us to relatives out east, people within our community. It's brought us back to our language, to our culture, to our history. Corn has just really led the way for a different lifestyle, and we are so much happier because of it.
There is a great deal of archival research in the book. There's historical accounts and oral histories kind of depicting early Oneida life before the nation even came to Wisconsin. And then there are tons of interviews with people in your community who are growing corn and like talking about their favorite ways to cook it. Can you just talk about what the process was like gathering all of the material and interviews for this book?
Yeah, that was a really amazing part of all this. I really had a wonderful time digging in the archives, trying to find stories and instances when our people talked about corn or corn was relevant at pivotal moments in our history. And then to gather all of that information and then go out into the community and ask the community their perspectives of our history, their relationship with growing the corn, eating the corn, childhood memories. You expect to hear certain things when you're going out there because you've done the research and you grow the corn yourself. But it was so much more than I could have ever anticipated to hear our community talk about our corn this way. It was so beautiful. And I was so happy to be able to weave their stories throughout our history in this book and to be able to share them back with the community. I'm really excited that it's finally available for people to hear our stories.
And I love the way that you present it, where, you know, you have these big chunks of text and it's like, okay, this person is speaking straight to us in their own words. Do you have any favorite tales that were shared with you or favorite memories?
Yeah, so there's so many memories in here. And just like, for example, we homeschooled our daughters. And I think during the writing of this book, they were, I believe, 15 and 16 or 15 and 17. But the younger daughter, you know how you tell them things and you think they're not really listening. They think they're not paying attention. But when I sat down and I interviewed her, she talked about our removal period, which, like so much of our history, was pretty traumatic when our people were removed from New York to what would later become Wisconsin. And she wondered about what varieties of seeds that our ancestors carried with them. But she also wondered, what varieties did we have to leave behind? And it was just really moving to me to know that she was having these thoughts about our seeds that, you know, I didn't even think about myself until, you know, she had started to talk about it. And so that one for sure. My mom has a really hilarious story about my great grandma. And her partner at the time was trying to light a gas burner in the breezeway between the garage and the house to cook some corn soup. And he lit the gas before he lit the match. And he ended up having a gas buildup and burnt his eyebrows off. And yeah. So there's just so many stories in here that corn is bringing us these stories and they're bringing us together and they're sharing with everybody who cares to hear about them.
Yeah, I love the stories. And I love that what you collected really runs the gamut from kind of what you described, these more like painful reflections that your daughter is having, to kind of hilarious stories. I think one that I remembered was someone who was like, oh, the elders don't like my corn casserole. Yes. Or something. So it's like so funny. I guess it strikes me that the way that those interviews are presented, you're preserving a lot of knowledge in this book with wisdom for many people. And I know outside of the book, you know, you've created this teaching farm with your family where people can reconnect and learn about corn and Oneida foodways and cultivation. What called you to this work?
So my husband and I, we were both raised in this community, but we didn't have access to a lot of that knowledge. And when we decided to grow our foods again, there wasn't a whole lot of places that we could go to figure out all of the things that we wanted to learn about. There were people in our community that did share some knowledge with us. We did go out east to gather knowledge there. So we gathered knowledge from all over the place. And even, you know, in the historical record about how we had traditionally grown our foods. When we were looking, sometimes there was shame and embarrassment because we didn't have the answers, because we didn't know about these foods. We didn't know what seeds we had, how to best grow them, because that knowledge had been taken from us through colonization, assimilation, and removal. And it took a lot of work to learn what we learn now or what we know now. And we're still learning. There's still so much for us to learn. So we wanted to create a safe space for people to learn with us so they didn't have to be embarrassed that they don't know these things already. And also for our seeds to come home, a safe space for those to grow. And then we can turn around and share them with the community as well.
It must have been really difficult just to try to grow foods at this subsistence level without having done that before. I imagine it was really frustrating and rewarding. I guess what were some of the challenges and who did you go to when you were trying to figure things out?
Lots of hurdles. Money. We don't have generational wealth for agriculture. You know, we had to refinance the house for a tractor, for a UTV. We were able to access some USDA grants at the beginning for a high tunnel, pollinator habitat, tree planting. Then when we formed a 501c3 2 years ago, then we had access to even more grants. So we were able to expand our teaching space, install a commercial certified kitchen on our farmstead so that we could bring people in and learn how to cook our traditional foods in a conventional setting. So there are all kinds of things that we have been able to do, but you know, money and knowledge are the two big hurdles that we had. But we're just plowing through literally and figuratively to try to find a way to make this happen. And so far we've been able to do that and we're having fun doing it.
This is WUWM's Lena Tran. I'm speaking with Rebecca Webster. She is an Oneida citizen and a corn grower and the author of a new book called Our Precious Corn. It's all about the Oneida relationship with corn. You obviously need land to grow food. And we have talked before about how the United Nations lost so much of its land through these shifts in federal Indian policy and non-Native people are able to acquire it. So I guess, you know, outside of what you and your husband are working on personally, what does the movement look like now to reconnect with that heritage and kind of surmount this land access issue?
Yeah, so I think within the tribal government structure, they are trying to find ways to make our agricultural land more accessible to individual tribal members who want to try things differently. We do have a handful of conventional tribal member farmers that have been farming for a long time. What seems to be percolating now is some farmers who are trying different things, you know, environmentally sensitive practices or just different ways to do things than has been historically done. In addition to that, we have some tribal members like us who are purchasing our own land on the reservation and just going in, you know, feet first, trying to figure all of this stuff out. So there's a few tribal members that are doing that as well. So I think there's just these different approaches to getting this knowledge base out there and sharing what we're learning as we do that.
Mm-hmm. And there's also this co-op, right? Where?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's called Ohelagu and we formed that in 2016. And that's right now, I think we have about 15 Oneida families in this co-op. And we farm between, you know, 4 and 7 acres a year, just depending on conditions and the needs at that time. So what we do is we conventionally plant our Tuscarora white corn together. That's one of the most common of our varieties of corn. And we do that with plows and tractors and to get the corn in the ground and the ground ready. And then we come through and we use a cultivator until the corn gets so high. But after that point, that's when it's very different than conventional planting in that we hand weed after that point and we hand harvest. So that's a pretty lengthy process. When we harvest the corn, we take the husks off and then we braid all of our corn and we hang it in a barn to dry for several months. And that, you know, historically has been the staple in our diets. So our goal is to make that corn more available for our community members.
And then there's this idea towards the end that corn can help your community prepare for an uncertain future. So it's like that's happened in the past and you're kind of doing that again. You talk about climate change or supply chain disruptions like we saw during the pandemic. Can you talk about why corn or even more broadly food sovereignty is food security?
Yeah, I think when we saw during the pandemic how the food chain just in parts just collapsed and was unstable, we ended up getting through that, but we saw the weaknesses in how that all works and our reliance on being able to go to the grocery store and have the foods that we're accustomed to be there and be available. I think by taking control and growing more of our own foods, especially foods that our bodies were meant to eat and not the highly processed foods that are available in the grocery store, I think that is a way to help us not only get healthy again, but to be secure in where our food comes from, to know what's in that food, and to know that it has historical and cultural connections to us as a people.
Rebecca Webster is the author of Our Precious Corn. She's an Oneida citizen, corn grower, and teacher. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran last year. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. There's a rare painting in the Milwaukee Public Museum's collection called Menominee Women. We'll learn all about it next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Public Museum has more than 4 million artifacts in its collections. Many of those items either haven't been displayed or have only been viewable during certain exhibitions. As part of our series Behind the Scenes at MPM, we'll examine one of those unseen items. It's a rare painting called Menominee Women, and it depicts a group of Native American women. Dawn Cher Tomei, the museum's anthropology curator, says it's a rare record of how Native women used European goods. Cher Tomei met with me and WUWM's Eddie Morales to share more about the artifact.
Are there any items here that haven't been displayed before that you plan to display in the future museum?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ones that we have on the table here, this particular piece has only been, was on temporary display just for a little while in a couple of exhibits. I love this painting. It's called Menominee Women, so it is also Wisconsin. It was made by an artist named Samuel Brooks in 1858, so before photography was prominent. And so it's very unusual also to have images of women, you know, at that time that were painted. So it's a wonderful record for the Menominee tribe to have this. And it shows exactly what they were wearing at the time, which is a combination of traditional clothing and also using trade items like ribbons and trade blankets, for example. And anyway, it's phenomenal. And it's got a pair. It's part of a pair. There's a Menominee men's painting as well. So, but one of the hidden features is that he recorded the men's names and the women's names are not present, which is actually par for the course during that time. Very kind of a Eurocentric perspective because women were not obviously as important in their eyes.
In the eyes of the Europeans who were creating this.
Exactly, yes. I mean, even though, you know, you have some tribes that are matrilineal, and they are the ones, you know, that the women are more of the political leaders, they wouldn't talk to them. They would only talk to the men, which was very disruptive. But anyway, it's really an exceptional painting, and I'm very excited that it's going to be on exhibit. So it's not a focus for our museum to have, or we didn't really focus on fine art in that sense. When you go to the history department, you'll see some, but it was more happenstance because we had been here decades before our historical society was founded. And so we were also kind of like the historical society for Milwaukee. So we have a lot of local material you might not find in a, you know, a nationally focused or globally focused natural history museum.
Can you describe just like the size of it and what the depiction is for listeners?
Yeah, so it's maybe 3 feet by 3.5 feet, mm-hmm. and with a wood frame, and it's there's a painting of five women and then two gentlemen here who are leaning. So the women are in the forefront, and that's really the focus. And the men are leaning against a tree. What I find really fascinating, and I use this interpretively, is that actually these men would have been further back, but he decided to bring them forefront because they're watching him. They're not letting him alone with women because it takes a long time to paint. And so he brought them forefront, but you could see the men's expression are saying, "I don't trust you." So it's very clear in the painting what they're communicating.
And it must have been restored, right?
Yes. So this, we did not have this originally, the men's painting we had for several decades. This actually came from an estate in California. So Samuel Brooks actually went to California after he left Wisconsin. And we didn't know this painting even existed. We only knew about the Menominee Men painting and some other paintings he did, which reside in the Historical Society. And so we were contacted by an estate, and they said, "We're contacting you because you're a museum in Wisconsin, and this is Menominee, and that Menominee reside here." And said, "We have this painting by Samuel Brooks, and that's called Menominee Women," but it was in horrible, horrible condition. And so we were very fortunate to work with a local individual who was a fine arts aficionado, and he loaned us the money to purchase it as well as the restoration. We were able to work with another foundation for the actual restoration, but it was in horrible condition, but like I said, it's a phenomenal record before photography. It's very rare to have this, and especially a group portraits, because you probably have seen, here's a picture of a guy, you know, a mayor, a governor, a soldier, but these are not quite as common. The restoration, you could see that the picture that you're looking at is some of the degradation of the painting, and it's very yellow and cracked, and even some of the faces are not discernible. It took many, many hours. We did not do it on site. We had a specialist work on it. But also the yellowing was not just the paint, but it wasn't glassed apparently, and so whoever was doing that was smoking as well. So it just had a lot of damage, you know, where it resided before in California. But we were excited to bring it home.
It is fascinating to see the two paintings juxtaposed because it's so clearly the same setting.
Mm-hmm. And he must have really liked this one to take it with him. You know, that's all I can say, that the artist resonated more with him than the other painting, which stayed here. So, and he was asked to do this by a benefactor. And at that time, oftentimes painters would have people who would ask them to paint certain things, a landscape. That's how they made their money. they would have a benefactor. And so he had one, you know, that actually paid him to paint these.
It's interesting to have a child pictured as well.
Yeah, there is a young girl here, and all of them are, young women. We hope to... It would be nice if we could find their names. That is something that we would like to do. We're not sure, and we have been talking to the Menominee Nation. We do consultation with all of the different tribes in Wisconsin for our future museum. And so they're helping us select cultural heritage items for the new museum, helping us tell their stories. So it's been exciting work, and so... This is something that we hope that we can provide, you know, their identity back to them.
If you can speak to this, how has that changed over the years of just collaboration with different Native nations and coming into not only in like contemporary times here with this museum, but also with the future museum? How has that changed over the years?
Well, I mean, you cannot do that anymore. You know, you can't just put a culture on exhibit without consultation or working with the source community, because they're the knowledge bearers, you know, that so it's really very important to have their voices, because it is their culture. You know, it is residing here. That's why I use that term, you know, that we don't own it in the traditional sense. So it's really critical, because this story is also so much richer. And so you want to work with the people who have the knowledge.
And then in the future museum, that's an extra effort going forward to make sure that they are involved in that?
Very much so. And it takes years. And we're collaborating with people from all across the world.
Dawn Cher Tomei is the anthropology curator at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke to me and WUWM's Eddie Morales for our series Behind the Scenes at MPM. You can find more about that at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from Milwaukee's outgoing district attorney about his time in office and the significance of that role. Plus, we'll tell you about Forest Home Cemetery's Spirits of the Silent City events, where you can walk amongst the headstones in the evening and learn about the people buried there. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.